Well, life is short, and usually it's very difficult to push everything in what you would like to say. So, what I'm going to do... What? Yeah, that's true. That's a real good point. Let me see. What I probably will do is I will start in a sense from the end. That is, I'm going to put probably I have to say a few words about this matter. The only thing should be added that I will make a special accent on this thing. This is atmospheric, essentially surface layer. And I will use some DNS and things which are not available here. And one of the things you will see that they are in a way very much similar in a variety of aspects, at least on the qualitative level. Now, what is my intention is to do this. And these are the main points which probably I will extend a little bit because I think that it is really necessary. Let us see. First of all, what I'm going to claim is that most of the non-linear processes, you will see what I mean by that, are associated with large strain, rather with large intense vorticity, and in this sense that all the non-linearities are reduced in vorticity or entropy-dominated regions. That is, strain-dominated regions are much more dynamically important. Second, that the alignment of vorticity, mostly with the largest eigenstrain, is the most important alignment, again, in respect with the nonlinear activity. The most intense nonlinearity happens where the vorticity is aligned not with the second eigenstrain, but with the largest one, with the most positive. And also, it is associated with finite curvature of vortex lines, which means that it is not associated with Burgers-like objects, as many people try to claim, unfortunately. Now, the second claim will be that there is no turbulence without structure or structures or whatever. I mean, I deliberately put it in a not very clear way. And I will skip this for the moment and go next and try to convince you that we have to look simultaneously and in parallel in entropy and strain production, and the latter one is in a sense more important. I will again explain what I mean by that. And the last thing probably I will be able to do is very briefly to give you quite interesting results which show that both these two processes are just essentially self-amplification, and in what sense, again, I will explain. If I will be able to say anything else, I will try, but I'm not sure this is really possible. So I will leave it for your observation for a while, and then I will get it back and forth from time to time. Now, what I mean by geometrical statistics, you have seen already, it is mostly not fractals or things of the kind. And just I will remind you that there is quite an interesting story about history about what geometrical statistics or geometry means. There is a lot of things. This is just some of that. And again, in order to save time, I'll remove it for a while and then I'll get it back. And now I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the experimental aspects, because the numerical ones are pretty standard, and if you have questions, I can answer them. So we used a kind of pretty crazy probe, which consists of five arrays having 20 wires, which the total scale of the probe, you see, it is here something a little bit above 3 millimeters probably. And, well, the Kolmogorov scale is typically something around less than millimeters, so you can yourself estimate what it is. And What is important that many questions arises in respect to how reliable it is and what you really do measure. Is it really true or not? Well, we did quite an extensive comparison of measurements in this paper and computations at the same R lambda, and these are few examples of how they compare. In the course of my presentation, you will see much more. And to understand this transparency, of course, you need the notations which are given there. So just two examples for the moment to show that these are not bad at all. This is the alignment between vorticity and the vortex stretching vector. And the second one is just there should be something else, but well, whatever. This is the right one. This is the behavior of the second eigenvalue, intermediate one, conditioned on this cosine, because it's important. And if I have time, I will explain why it is so much important. But you can see how similar they are. So the reliability of this thing was checked pretty carefully. I just give you one example. Now, I will switch on very briefly to explain what was the field experiment. Can you see anything? Yeah. So this is it's a kind of a box, and the permanent condition of the experiment is the box is therein at this point. It's a calibration box. The cost is $100,000. It's a very special one, automatic calibration unit. This is the rear part. You can push the air here, and the probe is from the opposite side, standing. And the normal position is permanent, continuous calibration, because you need to do the calibration in situ on this elevation, because if you do it somewhere else and then raise your probe, you lose all, you don't know the properties. This is calibrated by the same air where the measurements is going to be done. Now, the only thing is that we tilt it, we remove this stuff in 2 minutes, we bring it back, we make a measurement, and then we bring it back again, and we compare the calibration before and after. If they not coincide, then this thing is thrown out. Okay? Now, the thing is able, of course, to provide us with all the 9 velocity derivatives using Taylor hypothesis. So we have all the 9 velocity derivatives, and this is one of the most important things. Now, I'm going to start with what I call geometry of vortex stretching. And this is just associated with the fact that it's not enough. No phenomenology or arguments of the kind can help us to get more physical insight in the sense of details looking at things like that or like that. Because dimensional-wise, they are all omega cube or S cube or whatever, but the important point is that there is inherent geometrical relations which are important. These are the eigenvalues, and these are the eigenvectors of the rate of strain tensor. And for instance, entropy production can be given geometrical interpretation as just a scalar product of these two. This is obvious in a way, but when you look at this, you gain lots of interesting insights, and also the letter alpha is used for just like Peter Constantine did, because this is also the rate of change of vorticity magnitude. It's just the same quantity. So I leave it for a while, and I will just get over to some few aspects of this, just a little bit. The main known fact, of course, is that this quantity in the mean is positive because the known since Taylor, in his dispute with Karman, who assumed quite the contrary, that it is in the mean zero, one of the biggest mistakes of this great man. And of course this is reflected, for instance, in the PDFs. This is from the field experiment, by the way. In the PDFs of entropy production, and this is the third. This is the skewness or whatever of the rate of strain tensor with the sign minus. They distributed are quite similarly, but it doesn't have to let you think that this similarity goes beyond that. They are very different. You'll see what I mean by that. Of course, this asymmetry is reflected also in the asymmetry of the eigenvectors, eigenvalues of the rate of strain tensor. They are ordered in such a way that lambda 1 is positive, lambda 3 is negative, and lambda 2 is mixed. And the asymmetry, of course, is seen in the distribution of the lambda 2. By the way, if you want, you can calculate that this distribution for a random Gaussian, say, isotropic field, it's perfectly symmetric, and you can get a nice analytic expression, which unfortunately I didn't have with me. Now, this symmetry, of course, is much more nicely seen, and not only nicely seen, in looking at this cosine, as I mentioned before. And the important point is, it is my noise, yes? Well, why it is noisy, I don't understand. Heart beating, yeah. What is important is the following. This distribution is symmetric for a Gaussian field. And the important point I want to stress here, that whatever you do with the field, you can filter it and you can sample it as you like. You never, ever get a symmetric distribution. Specifically, well, this is quite amazing. Probably it's my tie, isn't it? Well, let us see. Well, it will be probably also noisy. Let's try, let's do it uppercut. Maybe it will be better. Specifically, if you take a condition, if you conditionally sample this on low values, for instance, low entropy and low strain, it still remains very much asymmetric. Very much asymmetric. If you replace this number by 0.1, this changes very little. Now, the asymmetry is essential. It's not few percent. Here it's below 0.4, and here is 1. So it's very essential. And this is a clear indication that, I mean, one of the indications I can bring you now, that there is no really background, weak background, for instance, in this sense, which is Gaussian. There is no such a thing. No, 0.1 is still almost the same. I checked. So, well, did you check this? This alignment? This alignment? This particular one. Well, I don't know. I don't find it nowhere. This is the result from the field. It's a little bit less resolved because we have problems of resolution. But here the feature is, one of the important features I want to mention is that this alignment is much stronger, and in numerical simulations even more than that, for strong strains than for strong entropy. And this is not really a very new result. I mean, in this respect, maybe this is not published, but for instance, Professor Shea did it in a way. He sampled mostly on strain than on vorticity, and he had got strong alignment as well. But what is interesting here is the following. Well, it's not good. It's pedagogically wrong, isn't it? It should be removed. No way. I will waste a little bit of time, but I will save lecture, isn't it?
Don't remove the shirt.
How the shirt I will not remove. How much time? Okay. I am the last one, so I can get a bonus. Yes. All right. Now, what is interesting also is that when you look at this thing or at this thing, you will see that it consists of three terms, and each makes its own contribution. So it depends on essentially three alignments. It's not only just one alignment, the most popular one between omega and lambda 2, but it depends on more than that. And I will just show you a little bit of that. So if you look at this cosine, you easily make a simple algebraic exercise, and you find out that this becomes, this can be large when you have two alignments, because the lambda 2 is positively skewed. And if you take the experimental data and look at that, you will see that the joint PDFs of this cosine and omega lambda 1 is positive, has a big maximum here, as should be. It's really absurd. With lambda 2, it has also a big maximum here, and with lambda 3, is quite different. So this already gives you an indication, we'll see it in a moment, that really entropy production happens, is associated with two qualitatively different things, roughly two. There is more than that. This is one is the alignment between omega and lambda 1, and the second one with the, is that one. Now, I have to show you it's a kind of a different presentation, but it is the same. These are the same things for the field experiment. Made in color coding, and you have this maxima here. It's not only 0, 1, but plus minus, because we wanted to see how symmetric the field is. It's a little bit asymmetric. These are the maxima here. And for lambda 2, you have also the same maxima. They are here. So, and this is all for the moment about this matter. Now, of course, I have to show you that the preferential alignment between omega and lambda 2, this is the intermediate eigenvector, is, of course, very strong. This is the one. The blue curve is the very well-known alignment. But this does not mean that these guys are the most dynamically important ones. I will return to this matter a bit later, because time is running out very fast. I will just show you one thing already. And this is that, in fact, if you make a joint PDF of this thing, for instance, you will see that the maximum of the PDF is somewhere here, and the difference here is large. So when you sample this way, you have a kind of a spurious effect. You have a strong increase of the but this is a wrong way of seeing that. There is a lot of points in the flow field with not strong vorticity, where the alignment is of the same kind, and also where the strain is not very large. There is much more than that. I will, if I have time, I will show you this in more detail. This is, of course, associated also with structure in a way. For instance, this is a visualization from floor, and the color code here is strength of the lambda 2 alignment. And you will see that lambda 2 alignment happens in much broader range of points than just strong vorticity. This is seen also on cross sections, which I can show you. The green is the alignment, and the red is strong vorticity. So it's just what I should mention in particular, because you have to believe what I'm showing you, is the comparison. This is experiment and grid simulation, and red is, of course, experiment. This is log, because you have to see this part, and here the resolution is, of course, suffering, so you don't see. It's not as good as you would like to have. Now, a few words about curvature. This is how this second alignment looks like when you sample the field in DNS on curvature. And when the curvature is large, essentially there is almost no referential alignment. It's an important point. Also, by the way, curvature is increasing with strain. This is also an important point. It is decreasing with omega, but it is increasing with strain. These are conditional samplings. This is very important because this means that having straight vertical objects is not really the right thing to look at the field. I have more on that, but I have to go and to proceed. And again, there is the... So, let's now see whether this claim could be a little bit more quantified. And this is what we are going to do, is just to see the contributions of terms of individual terms here, 1, 2, 3, and individual terms here. We can do it both numerically and experimentally. And this is... You will see? No? It's just continuation of the claim already done. And the claim is the following, that if you look at this, you will see that the largest contribution, roughly twice as much, comes from this guy, and not from this guy, in spite that the alignment is, the total preferential alignment is here. It is twice as large. This is from the grid experiments, and this is latest from our field experiments at Reynolds number 10 to 4. Now, the same behavior precisely, or more or less precisely, is observed for the rate. And also we looked at the W square, because W, it's a kind of L to norm, if you want. W is this. So it's interesting to see, because W square has the positive contribution from all the terms, obviously. And again, look what happens. This is the largest contribution, again. And also here. There is much more. You can, for instance, look at the...
I have a friendly question. What is the error bar of these numbers?
Probably. I wouldn't dare to tell that it is more than that, especially in the experimental results. Here, the error bar is standard. Numerical people know even better than me. So... I wouldn't. Now, I have much more data on the field experiment now, but probably there is no time to do that. So, this is an important point, because this drives us essentially to the next point. And the next point is the following. We have to make a comparison between strain and vorticity in a variety of senses. So, what is the reason? I mean, this is not the only reason. There are many reasons why we should really look at strain versus vorticity. And this is the list of the reasons. So, I probably should concentrate a little bit on the non-local relation between strain and vorticity, because this distribution, which I showed you, very similar one, doesn't mean much, because essentially if you look at the joint PDFs of, say, third moment versus entropy production, you see that they achieve largest values in different, even geometrical reasons if you check it. So this is an important thing, and precisely similar thing you can see in our field experiment as well. This is the... Now, these two guys are weakly correlated. The correlation in this particular case, the correlation coefficient, is just 0.15. Now, the precision of that is probably even even less, even worse. But it's quite reliable. Now, because, how much time I have? 15 minutes is beautiful. You know, it's very nice and convenient to do things in the so-called RQ plane. And I have a summary of some results in this plane. I just will remind you how it looks like. Where is the introductory should be also. So the RQ plane is just the plane of the invariance, of the invariance of the velocity gradient. And just to give you a little bit of information, don't be scared, don't be scared. Probably I should probably change it. Just a little bit of information. Okay, now have a look quickly what happens. I should put this here, then you will really see. So what happens is the following, just briefly. First of all, few words about the alignment with the second eigenvector. It happens, it is strong in three qualitatively different regions. It is strong here. I mean, I will look here. It is strong here. That is, here you have vortex filaments, roughly saying. Here you have strong entropy production. But what is interesting, that in this region, there is also strong, if you make conditional sampling, also strong alignment between omega and lambda 1. And how could it happen? It happens because it happens on different sets of points. Now, the most strong alignment between omega and lambda 1 happens here. But strain production here is very small. Now, for instance, in this region where you have vorticity compression, negative of entropy production, the total strain production is very large. Now you have also here, where you have a kind of sheet-like structures, you have, for instance, here you have strain production large, but entropy production very small. Now strain production, what is strain production? This is an end product of cascade. Who is dissipating the energy? Strain. So, and the same thing you can see here, entropy production is small, but this moderate, this region is very strong. Also nearby here is a little bit interesting, but I don't have time to expand it too much. Now, it's important that this information is not exhaustive, and that's why we use, for instance, this, because you need the relations between the two. There is much more to say, but I'm going to go on because... It's precisely, it's very much well related, because the large, what is large strain production here? It is precise, it corresponds, this is raw data, I don't use any models, I just use the real stuff. So large strain production is corresponding to large energy, energy dissipation, if you like, and consequently all the rest, okay? We can relate it more, I will put it here. There is more than that. I have to tell something else, and this is, where it is? Should be somewhere here. I already buried it. It's a pity. But, well, not really so much important. I have a similar summary where you can see curvature and things of the kind. And what you see there, that strong curvature is, strong linearities in this sense I was speaking about are associated with not small, I would say, a curvature. And this is a very important point as well. If I find it later on, I will show you this, but I'm not sure I will really be able to find it. This is the tear drop. Now, this is shown on the... This is the teardrop. These are joint PDF of these two, so it's just showing how it looks like. Now, a few words about what I call... just one more thing. It is related to the simple observation that if you look at the, if you compare the two equations for entropy production and for the strain production, 2 is here just because the mean of this is equal to m squared, you will realize immediately that the entropy production does not help, does not contribute to the cascade directly. On the contrary, it resists it, because the mean of that is positive, and it carries here a sign of minus. The only guy who makes the job is this one. This one in the mean is positive, is negatively skewed, and the only one which is essentially responsible for directly for cascade. This sounds a little bit rebellious, but this is really the case. I mean, you would ask, what is this? In the mean, it's zero. I have more information on that, so if you have questions, I can answer. So this is quite an important point. The only stray, the only guy who is doing the job is this term. And this is associated, of course, with the negative third eigenvalue. Now, the idea is not entirely new. This is what I mentioned. This is what Betjeve wrote in 1956, Journal of Fluid Mechanics, Volume 1. And he wrote directly the thing, something like that, that the important processes, he also associated this with entropy production, and this is true to a large extent, are associated with flow patterns which resemble jet collision rather than swirling contracting jets. And this is really true to a large extent, not totally. Now, let me show you something else. This means, by the way, that in a sense, vorticity cannot do without, of course, strain. Strain also on in the large run cannot, but on the small scale, I mean, on locally in a way, it does, because what happens is the following. Strain does the self-amplification, why self you'll see a bit later, by itself. It doesn't need vorticity. Vorticity is just opposing that. On the contrary, this guy is requiring that definitely. Now, you can see this I will just show you the field experiments only. If you look at, say, joint PDFs of, say, rates, I'm showing only the rates, you will see both that omega is quite correlated with S square and with omega square. But if you look at the same picture for triple F guy, you will find out that it is not really so, and it is almost decorrelated for omega square, but of course it is strongly almost decorrelated from the omega square, but of course it is correlated, look carefully, with S square. I have also DNS data which shows the same thing, so I'm not really going to waste for that my time, because I have also to say something about what I call entropy, what I call reduction or depression of nonlinearity. And this is, the claim is the following. All the quantities which of the kind you see marked here, this is the so-called tilting. This is the quantity responsible for the tilting of vorticity. All of them, and these, behave in such a way that conditionally sampled on strain are much larger than on entropy. And just I'm going to give you a few examples only. This one, see? So you see, for instance, the rate. The rate of entropy production conditioned on strain is roughly saying almost order of magnitude at large world is larger than conditioned on omega. The same thing is happens with the entropy, with the vortex stretching vector, and these things are reflected properly in PDFs, which I have here. And if you look at quantities like this, this is also happens. I mean, these are quantities involving pressure, Hessian, and you see how different they are. Pressure Hessians have just different qualitative behavior, and therefore the total nonlinear term is much larger in strain-dominated regions than in vorticity-dominated regions. And just for fun, one result from associated, for instance, with the quantity responsible for the tilting of vorticity, and deliberately showing you this from the field experiment, which is also nicely seen. And the last point related to that is the following. If you look and compare also the, I will just take one, compare also the viscous destruction of entropy with its production, but sampled on S and omega, you'll find out quite an interesting thing. In regions which are dominated by vorticity, they are not very much different. And you can see this comparing this color and this color. So this is here and here. On the contrary, if you look at the strain-dominated regions, you will see that the difference is very large. Yeah, it is his blue and blue. This one. This is the difference for the strain-dominated regions, and this is the difference for the entropy-dominated regions. So this means that these regions dominated by entropy are an approximate balance, as Jim yesterday told. You can see it quantitatively. Now, this means that their time life is much larger, because if you look at the equation, you will see immediately that this is just inverse time life. So the difference between them is their inverse time life. You want to see that? I will just bring the, where is my equations? I have lots of them, so that I'm finding one doesn't take much time. It's easily to dig one out. It is this one. And just look at, say, at this. If you divide it by omega square, all of them, this will be inverse time, right? And so this is what... So this is the reason why you can easily see them, because without that you wouldn't. And the strain-dominated regions have very short lifetime. It's a very fast, violent process, so it's very difficult to observe them. That's why we don't see them so much. Anyhow, this is more or less. Now I'm going to go to the last, thing I wanted to say is the so-called self-amplification. Now, it's quite an interesting thing. Well, what we did is the following. We just made a computation, standard, something like Reynolds R lambda about 200 plus, and we wanted to compare these things with these things, or these things with these things. And we have chosen, for some reason, two kind of forcing. One is ABC forcing, which is strongly helical. And this is a kind of thing which puts in some deliberate correlation between large and small scales, if you want. And the other one is purely non-helical. Now, the result is quite amazing. It appears that both this, all of them are more than three orders of magnitude smaller than these. And this is the table. Now, it's not only true in the mean, it's true also for the maxima and minima. I used here just maximum of modulus. And in this sense, I'm saying that these processes are just self-amplification. On the level of velocity derivatives, these guys are totally unimportant. They are irrelevant. And I was very much, I was looking for a literature where somebody did such a comparison. It appears to be that nobody did this. We checked. Now it is more than five cases. We have many. We have tried all kinds of cases, random and deterministic forcing. As long as you do your forcing on large scale, nobody cares about that. This is, I think, quite a fundamental result, which is universal in a sense. It's qualitatively universal. This is a kind of universality, and it is true at very modest Reynolds numbers. By the way, if you go in Reynolds number, down, up, we still didn't do because it's expensive. If you don't do below, say, Reynolds number, R lambda 50, nothing happens. The orders of magnitude remains the same. It's not very sensitive. This thing, of course, is reflected also in alignment properties. When you force velocity, in order to put in energy, you should have alignment. But you do not have, of course, almost any alignment if you speak about, say, omega and curl of the I think I don't have time anymore, yeah? So what I'm going to do is just do the following thing. I will just go back to the main points again. I started from that, and now you are familiar with that, so it's easier. The only difference is that the last point has been changed. And this is the main thing. And, it relates to the question which I put here for discussion. And this is all I could stick in this short time. Thank you very much for your patience. Yeah.
And then we have this very nice phenomenological model of Chertkov and Shriman and so forth. Of course, they're dealing with a different quantity. They're looking at coarse grain.
Yeah.
But can we say from your experimental data that we sort of basically agree with their picture, or is there some aspect of it where you think their phenomenology is inadequate? I didn't understand what you were trying to
Well, I don't think that they have lots of phenomenology. I mean, they brought you the results and you see them. I mean, if we get back to this picture, okay? Well, the basic result is, for instance, that, probably I should say more than that, but I will be a bit critical, so... let me try to dig out something. There is a problem with the. My main point of disagreement is just like in the paper of Borel, is the approximation of this flux as they do. I believe that there is a major discrepancy in our view of that thing, and this is not a view, it's just a matter of looking at the raw equations. What I mean by that is the following. I will just dig out the equations in a second, because I need the other set, and it's probably waiting for me here. Yeah. I mean the following thing. When I look at the strain production in the term of raw, not coarse grains, I see the following thing. The only guy who is doing this job, in the mean, say, okay, is this one. This term enters negative. It opposes strain production, which is not the case in the Borel and your model. This term for the flux of energy, which is not the same, but enters there with a sign plus. And I, frankly, to say, I'm a little bit alarmed with that. Okay? Now, I found this one. What? I'm looking at the strain production. Yes. How about what? I don't care about that because energy dissipation is unrelated dynamically to vorticity. Well, I care about production of the guy who is responsible for dissipation. And this is related to energy flux, right? I don't know what it is. I'm sorry. Because here I have to extend to a much more radical view. It depends on energy flux depends on the way how you decompose the field. And so it's essentially decomposition representation dependent. And as such, to my peasant view, it is unacceptable because energy flux should be a thing which is, as a physical process, should be decomposition dependent. The nature doesn't know anything about our decompositions we make with the nature. So if energy flux should be independent, how we decompose the field, and it is not, and therefore I avoided this. Sorry about my ignorance, but this is the way I'm looking at the thing. Maybe. All right. Well, I do not insist on that because these are not totally the same things. By the way, well, maybe. Well, it's even better than. It's even better.
Okay.
I am Arkady.
These are truly awesome measurements. How long does it take you to make a 20-wire?
You want to know the story? I have 2 minutes for that. I will tell you. I was crazy about turbulence for a long time, though I couldn't really get to that for a long time for non-scientific reasons. And the first time, this probe was done by myself. I took my sabbatical and did it. Now, this field experiment, only the preparation, took more than 4 years and over $450,000. It was an incredible thing, but we did it. How large the probe is? Well, I showed it. I will show you it again. I will show you it again. It's here. Again, this is now. This scale here is varying between 2.4 to 2.58 millimeters. And so this scale you can calculate. This is a diagonal, so you can see it's about more than 3 millimeters, 3.2 or so. So it's a very difficult thing, and the typical length of this wire is a little bit more. It's about 0.5 millimeter. It's inclined, and it's incredible. But now I'm lucky. I have got a PhD, an MSc student. Who was in the past a jeweler, so he is doing this much better than me. I am already far behind. But this is not the only thing. For instance, the calibration is a kind of thing which, if you do not do it properly, you will not do anything. All this thing is very expensive, not only for the technological reasons that things are, the components are taken. From the same mechanisms which are used to point the laser pointer when the fighters are pointing their bombs to particular or rock or missiles or whatever. This is at this level of precision. Otherwise, you cannot do this. Even in this case, we have lots of noise. And I told you, 20% is quite... Well, anyhow, this is what I can tell you. Now, this one which was lost.